Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which these events ordinarily take place, and pay my respects to elders past and present. I also acknowledge that I'm speaking to you today from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respect to their elders past and present, to their custodianship, as well as Yorta Yorta elders past and present, and their custodianship. I acknowledge that the sovereignty of First Nations on this continent remains unceded. My name is Declan Fry, and I'm a writer and proud descendant of the Yorta Yorta. I was born on Wongatha country in Kalgoorlie, and have written for various publications, including Meanjin, Australian Book Review, Kill Your Darlings, Westerly, Overland, and elsewhere. My guest today is Claire G. Coleman, a Noongar woman whose family have belonged to the south coast of Western Australia since time immemorial. She writes fiction, essays, and poetry, and has lived most of her life in and around Melbourne. She wrote a Black and White Fellowship award-winning manuscript, Terra Nullius, while travelling around Australia in a caravan. It was awarded the Norma K. Hemming Award and was shortlisted for the 2018 Stella Prize and Best Sci-Fi Novel in the 2017 Aurelius Awards. The Old Lie, her second novel, appeared late last year. Claire, welcome.
Hi, nice to meet you. Though we're not meeting in person, which is a big shame.
No, it is. It's loosening up, and hopefully 2021 we can see people in the flesh and the blood. I want to ask you, first of all, you've published this year alone a short story in the Saturday paper, online essays for Meanjin, work in Art Collector magazine, your first novella in Griffith Review, not to mention releasing two novels in the space of 2 years. What is the secret to your prodigious output, and where can I buy some?
You can buy a lot of it at the coffee shop.
Well, that's it. That's where we've all been. So
it's a lot of coffee, and it's sometimes seasoned when I hit writer's block by some tequila, never getting quite enough sleep.
It's remarkable, because I hear that you've got stories like Graham Greene, where apparently they got into the office and did an hour's writing and then spent all the time after midday drinking.
Yeah, that would be a lovely world, wouldn't it?
Not what you're advocating necessarily.
Well, the thing is, even 20 years ago, authors earned a lot more for our work. I know that the average earnings for writing an essay was around $1 a word 30 years ago, and we're lucky if we get $1 a word now. So it's quite a tight situation now, and I think for the most part, the days of authors having a jolly old time relaxing with the occasional writing, those days are long gone.
You talk about wanting to frame your novels in ways that will reach more people, particularly using speculative fiction as a framing device. What events or experiences led you to conclude that there was a need for that approach?
Well, there's a common refrain, which I'm sure you've heard and most of the audience will have heard, of people saying two things. Firstly, they say that the invasion and colonization of Australia were a good thing, or peaceful, or non-violent, or that they that it was good for the Aboriginal people, or that Aboriginal people didn't get hurt much, or obvious lies. I mean, the first people that Captain Cook saw upon landing in Australia, he shot one of them. He didn't kill him, but he shot at someone. I mean, that's the clue. Yeah, the colonization is violent. So I was challenged by that, and I was challenged by these people saying that the colonization of Australia was a long time ago, and a lot of these people don't know that the last tribal people to leave their tribal lives and join this so-called civilization that we have in Australia were in the mid-80s. When I was a child, not before we were all born. So I was looking at those things, and obviously Although some people have been reached by the mainstream fiction of the Aboriginal communities, by historical fiction and by reading history books, and some people have learned properly from school, there's a lot of people out there who haven't, who have somehow either not received the genuine history of Australia or have not been affected by it, have not absorbed it. So Terra Nullius was really an attempt to find a way to help people absorb the true history of this country and personalize it, so that in a way I'm trying to decolonize this entire country, not just decolonize myself or help other Aboriginal people decolonize, but to give an imperative also for the colonizers to decolonize themselves. And the only way to do that is to tell the truth. But people don't want to know the truth. So sometimes the best way to tell the truth is to wrap the truth in the fantastical. And that's kind of what drove me to do what I did. It's a common thing. It's all throughout the history of literature. Real, genuine truths have been wrapped in the fantastical and then presented to the audience and better absorbed that way than they are in the in like so-called factual writing.
Speaking of the fantastical, you mentioned people coming to factual writing, learning something, but it seems to be a recurring thing that every 10, 20 years, writers have to come back and remind people, because I think to myself, well, Sally Morgan was a bestseller in the early 90s with My Place. And, you know, now we have things like Dark Emu and your work that have sold quite well. Do you ever worry that 10, 20, 30 years from now, you or the generation after you will have to be repeating these things?
Of course, that's a worry. That could happen. But the thing is that well-written work tends to have longevity, or a work that's that managed to get to a broad audience tends to have longevity. So the works of Sally Morgan are still educating people about the true history of Australia now. People still find out about the stolen generations from reading My Place. So the fact that they're old and they've been partially forgotten, if I can say they've been partially forgotten, because I don't think they have, but then occasionally someone will still find the truth from having been given that book or told about that book or doing it in school. All those things increase the chance of people learning more. And I think I'm hoping a time will come when we no longer have to teach people about colonization, because the weight of material they've got to learn from is so huge that there's no way to avoid it anymore. So I'm hoping that – I don't think my published work is going to end people's belief in colonization being good or will end Australia's blindness about what colonization is. I don't think I can do that. But I think that if there's enough weight of material, that can do it. And what I'm trying to do is add my 2 cents worth to the top of the pile in the hope that someone else add their 2 cents on top, and then eventually there'll be enough, there'll be an avalanche of information, and the myths will end, and that's what we're going to do. And certainly I'm hoping that Terra Nullius and The Old Lie will still be selling in 10 years. Let's hope for that. And I hope that they'll continue to change people's thinking in 10 years' time. I can hope that they end up in schools in 10 years' time.
It's interesting that the question of what gets read in the future, because your own work, you draw a lot in The Old Lie on two poets, Wilfred Owen and Yeats. And I remember you actually quoted a Yeats poem in an Australian Book Review podcast you did this year, I think, early this year. What attracts you to poets like Yeats or Wilfred Owen?
It's kind of different things attract me to the two of them, but there's also something that got a similarity as well. One thing that attracts me to them is, although they are, we consider them to be, you know, white poets, and they are white poets, they went through a kind of hardship caused by the colonization in a similar way that we do, and the way they wrote it expresses, and I'll get back to that in a minute, but the way they wrote that expresses in a way that the the people who ignore colonization can face it. Yeats, for example, he was an Irishman, and he was part of the first incarnation of the Irish Republican Army, and he was involved in the Easter uprising, and the Easter uprising was the moment when the modern Sinn Féin and the modern IRA started, which was a bunch of Irish Republicans occupied a government building in Northern Ireland in protest. But rather than negotiating or anything, the British shelled most of the city flat. And from that moment was born the kind of the broader Irish rebellion. So you get that. And, of course, Wilfred Owen, he died in the trenches in World War II. So when somebody has been in that sort of abjected, endangered environment and then writes about it themselves, it's a bit different to the thing we often have, which is people telling these stories who have had nothing to do with it. And Wilfred Owen in particular is powerfully to use for that in that regard, because his war poems were written in the trenches. And war poems were being used by the British Empire to inspire soldiers to fight. And Wilfred Owen was writing his responses in the trenches and sending them to his friends in England to get them published in protest against the propaganda they're being fed. So in a way, I suppose you could say that some poets have always been part of the counter-propaganda effort of the empire, have been part of truth-telling. And I think poetry has always been part of truth-telling. It's something we've forgotten. We've forgotten that activist poetry exists. And maybe, well, not everyone's forgotten, because I know some people who consider themselves to be activist poets. But maybe we should consider that it's time to revive activist poetry.
Mm, certainly among mob, I mean, Charmaine Paper Talk Green would be one of the most explicit in announcing activism as one of her aims. Among non-Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander poets, there's people like John Kinsella that she collaborated with. What do you feel you get in writing in a medium like poetry that you don't get in prose?
Poetry was actually my first love as a writer. I was writing poetry for a very long time before I wrote Terminalius. Arguably not as successfully. I got my first published poem published after publishing Terminalius, even though I'd been writing poetry for, I can't even remember how many years I've been writing poetry for. Poetry, it enables you to kind of hone your writing ability like nothing else can. And it's got a rhythm and a power, and it's a strength. And in a way, it's kind of more painterly. You're putting down words like a painter putting down paint with a stroke of a brush. And in a poem, every word in itself matters, and an entire poem can hinge on one word. And all that's true of prose. Like in prose, words matter. But because in prose you've got a lot more words to play with, in the shortest short story is generally longer than a long poem in word count. So in prose you've got a lot more words to play with, but in poetry you can distill the essence of what you're trying to say and distill the essence of language like no other medium can. And for that reason, I kind of love it. And poetry is a strong driver of the way I write my fiction. I try and incorporate kind of poetic ways of looking at language into my prose and into my nonfiction, because I think those tools that poetry has given us in language are powerful and shouldn't be underestimated.
I'd actually like to raise one of your poems that I quite like as an entry to a broader discussion about travel in your work, because there's a lot of travel. There's the poem you published in Firefront, curated by Alison Whittaker, called I'm the Road, where you say, I remember travels more than I remember a home. And it led me to think about the fact that you wrote Terranullius while traveling the continent. Terranullius itself features a protagonist, Jackie, who's always running. The characters in The Old Lie are often seeking a way home. What does travel mean to you? both, I suppose, as a practice and as a theme in your work?
Traveling my work is incredibly complicated. My family, when I was growing up, traveling was very much a big thing. Road trips were our thing. Going camping in road trips, long drives were like my family's experience, was my experience of growing up. And for a long time, kind of road trips were what I did when I couldn't cope with the world anymore. I just jump in my car, and sometimes I'll just jump in my car and drive, completely responsibly, no plan, no direction, nothing. I just go. Sometimes I end up miles from anywhere. And then when I ended up homeless on the streets of Melbourne, I managed to save up and get a vehicle. And once I had a vehicle, I thought, well, if I'm going to be homeless sleeping in my car on the streets of Melbourne, I might as well be homeless sleeping in my car on a riverbank or in a caravan park or in a street, in a back street of a small town. So I just left and went traveling. But then during my travels in 2015, I returned to country. And when I returned to country, as part of the large trip around Australia, the first stop was return to country. That's when everything in my life changed. The return to country, it was like a light switch being flicked on. Suddenly, everything fell into place, and my writing career, although I tried to be a writer before, everything started then. So writing and traveling has taken on almost spiritual landscape in my life, in that most of the good things that have happened in my life have happened while writing something on the road. And funny thing is, travels in the old lie quite a lot, because although it wasn't written traveling around Australia on a big long road trip, someone asked me about traveling the old lie once, and I had to think about it because I hadn't really thought about it. It was like one of the first interviews about that book. And it suddenly occurred to me that about half of the writing process, I was traveling. I was actually going up through the centre, up to Alice Springs. But the other half of it, I was book touring of my writing. I was book touring for Terra Nullius, which meant I spent countless hours editing and writing that novel in airport departure lounges.
Mm.
And frankly, in the old lie, Jimmy spends a lot of time stuck in airport departure lounges, essentially. Yeah. So it's like maybe it's just that I can't find a way to remove my life from my writing. But it seems if I'm on the road a lot, my characters are as well. And certainly, I've written my third novel now. It's in the edit process. And that was not written on the road. That was written sitting in a house in Melbourne. So we'll see if that's affected that. But and I suppose if you're going to – I always say about traveling, I say if you're going to be homeless, you might as well be homeless going somewhere nice rather than sitting in your ass watching television. Or sitting on – not even sitting in your ass watching television. You're going to be homeless, you might as well be in a vehicle rather than sitting on your ass in a street corner. It's not that much difference, really.
Do you have a sense of being homeless?
Not anymore. I'm actually in my home now. Because of my relative success at writing, I'm now renting a house for the first time in 15 years or something ridiculous like that. I've been renting for about a year and a half. And that's wild. That is absolutely wild, having to pay rent and stuff like that. And it was really hard because I didn't have any rental references, and I had to use character references to get a rent. And my character references were a publisher and a newspaper editor. So I think that helped.
There's ironies too, I think, when you say you're renting, and actually there is another line in I Am the Road where you talk about one day. Wish to, hope to, dream, buy some of my grandfather's country back, pay the thieves for stolen goods. Tell me how that's going. Is that, well, your, is that what you're saving up for next?
It is, yeah. That's kind of what I'm saving up for next. I'm saving up to buy some country back. The funny thing is, it's this real thing that I'm paying white fella rent in Wurundjeri land. And the ones you aren't getting the rent, they should be, but some white fella's getting the rent. I don't even know who it is because through an estate agent. I don't even know who my landlord is. So I'm paying money for stolen land just so that I can have a roof over my head, which is fortunate with the hell year 2020's been. It's really ironic that I'm paying rent to rent stolen goods. It's crazy. It's like I often joke that colonization is some dude steals your car and you say, hey, dude, you stole my car. And they say, okay, well, that's okay. I'll rent it back to you. Because that's what it's like. Oh, we've stolen your land. Oh, you can rent it back. You can think, then you won't be homeless.
There's always that bind. I wonder about, do you have any sense in using speculative fiction to convey so much in your work? I mean, there's across Terra Nullius and The Old Lie, we have references to the Stolen Generations, nuclear testing, refugees, deaths in custody, the black diggers who went to war. Are there any limits to the use of speculative fiction in conveying First Nations lives and histories, or indeed conveying socio-political issues generally?
I don't think so. I can't see there being a limit because speculative fiction, the way it really works in telling stories and telling truth is instead of – all you're doing really is instead of wrapping your story around a world, you're wrapping a world around your story. So that's the only difference. So if somebody's got a story to tell, they can create whatever speculative world they want in order to tell it. So I don't think there's any limit on what can be done as far as telling the truth about how our people have been treated. I don't think there's any limit to what can be done. And I'm hoping, it might sound strange because I think a lot of people would go, if they are kind of perhaps one of the better sellers in speculative fiction in the country, that they wouldn't want more people to enter the market. But I'm the exact opposite. I hope every young Indigenous person who wants to write speculative fiction to tell a story or to force people to face the truth, I hope they sit down and write a speculative fiction novel or even a short story or a play or something in order to get our stories out. I want there to be more out there because even if every Australian was forced to buy Terra Nullius, which of course would be ridiculous, I wouldn't ever want that. Even if they were, though, there's still room for more books. There's always room for more stuff. And I don't think that for our mobs, I don't think it's us if we come out with a great book. I don't think we're taking market away from each other. I think we're taking away from the white fella, and that's fine. I'll take their book sales away any day because they're living on our land anyway. So we've got to get something out of it. And I think in recently there's been a lot of stuff appearing that demonstrates that you don't have to even write prose to use speculative fiction. In the book, I'm trying to remember what it's called. I think it's After Australia. Amble and Quai Molyneux wrote a speculative fiction poem and was published in that. I am developing at the moment a speculative fiction play, which was
as well as a third novel.
Yes,
that's the coffee.
That's the coffee.
Must be coffee.
So it's like I don't think there's any limit to what can be done. Speculative fiction, poetry can be done, plays. We've got movies. We had Clever Man, and I'm sure there's other opportunities. So I think we should all just if people like speculative fiction, they should just go for it. And I think that there used to be a thing where people thought speculative fiction was less respectable, but I think that's slowly dying, that attitude. And I think we should just all go for it.
Did you ever experiment with other modes? What was your initial impetus to use speculative fiction?
I was always writing poetry. I have tried to write serious, so-called literary or contemporary realist prose. I don't think literary fiction exists, even though I'm published by in a literary fiction department. I don't think such a thing exists. I think calling it realist is probably more accurate. The idea for Terra Nullius, when I had the idea, and the idea for Terra Nullius was where it all began, that idea would only work as speculative fiction. And also, I read speculative fiction or science fiction. I read science fiction, fantasy, and horror for most of my relaxation reading. So I thought, well, if I'm going to – I had this idea that only works as speculative fiction. I like reading it. I knew that Indigenous speculative fiction is so minority that it may as well not exist. And that could have stopped me, but it didn't. I knew that I'd been told that
Do you mean in the local context or globally as well?
Locally. Globally, it's a lot bigger. Like in America and in Africa, it's much bigger than it is here. But also I knew that in Australia there's always been a thing that publishers won't publish adult sci-fi in Australia. It's a thing. Everyone always talked about it. When you talk about writing speculative fiction or science fiction, they'll go, yeah, but Australian publishers won't publish adult sci-fi in Australia. Maybe that'll change because of the success of Terra Nullius. Maybe people will go, well, let's try and find another one of them, but let's hope so. But I didn't let that stop me because I couldn't think of any other way to do what I wanted to do. And I think that's the important thing. I think it's important to not write for a market, but the most important thing is to write the story that you want to see in the world is a story you should write.
What was the limitation when you mentioned you tried writing it as realist prose? What did you butt up against that made that impossible? Why is it that it could only be speculative fiction?
Well, I didn't even try it. It didn't get very far, this idea. Because the Terra Nullius hinges on the twist, and the twist only works as speculative fiction anyway. So there's that. But there's also the limitation for me in realist historical fiction, which is what it would have had to have been, is that historical fiction, there's a certain fidelity to, or I suppose a certain requirement to factual accuracy. In speculative fiction, you can focus on the truth, but you can focus on the truth as a broad concept, on the idea of what happened rather than getting down to the nitty-gritty of the truth. To use an example, I could have written The Old Lie as a historical fiction novel. It would have worked. That one would have worked, historical fiction. But technically, if you do that and you move the date of a battle or you move the position of a city, the audience could get narky, or it just causes difficulties. So instead of doing that, I decided to write the novel again as speculative fiction, because you don't have to worry about being accurate to the nitty gritty. You can just focus on broad stroke truths instead.
And it's funny that you say you would have felt more comfortable writing it in a realist mode, because I was wondering as I read The Old Lie why and how you decided to at times have that fidelity to real life, for example, referencing Alice Springs by name,
yep,
and having these moments where there is reference to the earthly world, but generally relating the story as a futurist science fiction.
It also helps that at the moment I am the only published Indigenous Australian published author of adult space opera.
It's a title to have.
And I was having a joke with a couple of science fiction authors I know who are published mostly in the United States. Because they said they haven't even tried for a while to get a space software published because no Australian publisher will touch it. And I've done it. So,
and it'd be a space opera with David Bowie, I imagine, because there is that reference to Ziggy's.
There is
a, it does feel.
You're the second person ever to have mentioned the references to the Bowie-esque mention to Ziggy's, yeah. The Ziggy Stardust, Ziggy the Giant Spider, yeah. That was an obvious Bowie reference. And there's actually little music Easter eggs all through my novels. And the reason is I'm an obsessive listener to music while writing.
Mm.
I very rarely write a first draft without music playing.
I'm similar, and I was very, very pleased to see Solid Rock at the start of Terra Nullius because I just love music, and I'm the same. I feel that music has so much poetry both in its nonverbal elements and, of course, in its lyrics, and just as a force and a force of energy that can propel your thinking.
And also when I'm working on more than one thing at a time, which I normally am, you normally don't have much choice. To use an example, if you're writing a novel, if you want a novel out every year, it's even harder. If you want a novel out every 2 years, which I want a novel out every 2 years, I like one every year, but I don't think I'm capable. You need to be, when you're writing your draft for a novel, you're editing the one before.
Why is that?
Because it from the first draft to from the end, finishing your first draft to publication of the novel is generally about 18 months. So there's an 18-month overlap between. So you have to hand in a novel almost about 6 months after the one before is released.
And you feel the need to fill that time.
I like I would, if I could, I would try and get a novel out of a year.
Hmm.
I would try. I know people who've done more than that, and they drive me insane because I don't know how they do it. But I would. I'd try and do a novel every year. Most girls have got a lot to say, but I'm always every time I'm doing anything, I'm always doing something else. Either I've got novel edits to do, and I've got commissioned essays to do. Or I've got, and I'm writing a first draft of a novel, and I'm editing another novel. Or in this case, I'm currently editing a novel, editing a play, and I've got 4 essay commissions or something due in the next couple of weeks. And the reason I'm talking about this is because music helps with that as well. I have different playlists for each project, and when I put the playlist on, it helps me understand what it is at that time I'm writing.
What music's helping you right now? What's the soundtrack to the current work?
The most recent thing I was doing, I've just finished the edit of my play, and my play is called Black Betty at the End of the World. And I can say that because that's already been announced when I got a fellowship to write it. And so I've been listening to a lot of Nick Cave and Bad Seeds, particularly Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds version of Black Betty, which is brilliant. Often it's when I was writing Terra Nullius, I was listening to a lot of desert reggae. I love desert reggae. Actually, The Old Lie had a playlist of largely desert reggae as well.
There's a futurist element almost in Nick Cave, for that matter. Mm. He sets these narratives in a gothic kind of past, but it feels so colourful that it could be kind of camp or futurist as well.
There's actual, I think if any artist gets, if there's any secret references to music, there's probably more to Nick Cave than any other band, any other musician. I'm not sure why.
Well, he's a published author himself, I suppose.
He is, yeah.
He's got literary interests. I'd love to just draw out something you mentioned earlier when you talked about marginalized authors and the concept some people may have that it's a zero-sum game, the publishing world, and you disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I'll give an example. It's really kind of slightly dodgy example for a lot of reasons, but when Harry Potter was published, the kids who picked it up weren't readers who picked up Harry Potter instead of something else. they were non-readers picking up Harry Potter and reading it. In the case of my writing, if Terra Nullius continues to be relatively successful, and the sales haven't dropped off far in the last couple of years, so it's continuing, I don't think another person appearing on the landscape will take away sales from me. What's more likely to happen is someone might read Terra Nullius, then move on to another Indigenous speculative fiction writer, or they might read, you know, if you wrote a novel, Declan, if you wrote a spec fiction novel tomorrow or started one tomorrow and finish it in a couple of years, it gets published, and someone reads your novel, they might go look for more of the same and find mine.
Claire, we discussed at the start of the interview we couldn't talk about my work in progress, but no, go on.
Yeah, so the thing is that in a way, what we can do is rather than worrying about whose books people are going to read, write good enough books that people are going to that reading increases overall.
Where does this idea that there is a zero sum game come from? Do you think is it an illusion, a myth, a kind of divide and conquer idea to spread fear among authors who are afraid there won't be enough pieces of the pie, or is it based on any reality?
I don't know. Maybe it is. There is a little reality to it. I don't know. I don't know. I think a lot of the time, people are looking for an excuse to be competitive, rather than they're competitive because they believe in a zero-sum game. It could be that they believe in a zero-sum game because they want to be competitive. That is one possibility. The other possibilities are that people think of the market as finite. And I suppose a market is probably one of the few things in our society that isn't finite. There's 7 billion people on Earth by now? If not, then nearly that. I'd say that they're not that 80% of them. You could not say with certainty that even 5% of those people bought a book this week. Mm. So there's the more good books there are, the more chance there is for people to buy books. And also, let's not forget that in reality, particularly for us as First Nations people, when we increase the sales of our books, we're not taking sales to each other. What we're really doing is robbing sales from the writers in the past who wrote about us.
It's an interesting way to put it.
If we can get people to read things like Terra Nullius, The Old Lie, Benung by Kim Scott, anything by Alexis Wright, if we can get people to read any of those books, Tony Burchard books, Tale June Winchard books, any book you like, we can get people to read those rather than the bullshit written about Indigenous people for the last 230 years, then that's a good thing. And I don't think it's a bad thing to steal from the classics. The classic example I use is schools. Why wouldn't the education system want to support living authors by no longer teaching crusty old dead books to young people? The crusty old dead authors aren't getting any royalties, right? It's not going to save the career of a crusty dead author. Shakespeare won't become rich because kids are still studying his books. Whereas if the schools start teaching a contemporary book by an Indigenous person or by an African diaspora writer or anything, not only will it reduce racism, but it will actually give a boost to the career of somebody who may only be able to write another book because they're selling the book they've got. So every time that someone buys a book by a marginalized author, they're giving that author the financial incentive to produce more books, because being a writer is hard. And writers don't earn much money. Not many of us earn a living from it. And I think anything people can do to increase the sales of living authors, so that living authors don't have to get a day job, You know, if someone's waiting tables rather than writing, that's less books that are being produced.
And it sounds like you have a real belief in literature there.
I do.
And its power to change, yeah.
I do. I believe in stories. If people ask me, I always say that we are defined by story, both the stories we are told and the stories we tell ourselves. We tell the world a story about ourselves. We tell ourselves a story about ourselves. And each person does. And if you change the story that's told about you, or the story you tell yourself about yourself, you change the world. And only, I think, not only can story change the world, I think they're one of the most powerful forces to change the world.
Claire, it has been an absolute pleasure. I want to thank you again for making the time.
Thank you.
To have a yarn. And your most recent novel, The Old Lie, published and available at your local independent bookstores. I urge anyone to run out and grab a copy. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great fun.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.